Welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Lewis Friedberg, Executive Director of EdSource, and I'll be your moderator of this evening's program. Tonight we have invited a panel of education experts to discuss the new K-12 Common Core state standards that are currently being rolled out in schools across California and across the United States. The inspiration for this program came from a seed planted by Camilla Smith, who's a generous member of the Commonwealth Club and a graduate of Columbia's University's Teachers College in New York. We are grateful to her for making this discussion about educating America's children come to life, as well as to her husband, George Smith, for his work as a faithful member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Directors. Our goal here tonight is for us to separate fact from the myths about the Common Core and to gain a deeper understanding of what the stakes are to get this right for our children and our country. There have been many reforms that have come and gone over the last several decades, and this latest reform has raised lots of questions about whether this will be more successful than some of the other reforms that have been attempted. We hope to outline the prospects for its implementation across the country, and our guests will help enlarge our understanding and perspective of the Common Core. So let me introduce the panelists. First of all, Dr. Susan Furman is president of Columbia University's Teachers College. We are very grateful that you have come to California for this event and for generously supporting us in producing this program. Thank you very much. Michael Kirst is president of the California State Board of Education and Stanford University Professor Emeritus of Education and Business Administration. And I should just mention that Professor Kirst is one of two people in the Brown administration who occupies the same position now as he did in 1975 in the first Brown administration. I should also add that this is basically a volunteer position. He doesn't get paid anything for this. Let's welcome Mike Kirst. And finally, for the person who actually has to do the work, Christina Lundy is a literacy coordinator and teacher from the Novato Elementary. She's in Novato in the district's Olive Elementary School. Welcome, Christina. Let me start with Susan Furman. What, in a nutshell, are the Common Core standards? I think this is one of these terms that immediately is to most of us is kind of jargon. But tell us briefly what are these standards?
These are expectations for what students should know and be able to do, K through 12 in English language arts and mathematics. And they were developed by consortia of states working together through the Chief State School Officers Association and the National Governors Association. Experts were funded with money from the Gates Foundation and others to write these standards. There were a series of consultations, and then at first, about 46 states adopted them.
So, could you help just clarify a little bit of the confusion between standards and curriculum? Is this a curriculum, or what is the difference there?
No, a curriculum is what you would need if you were actually going to teach to the standards. The curriculum would specify the specific units, the materials, how you were going to teach the skills and the knowledge that the standards were expecting or demanding.
And another question in terms of the substance of the standards. Basically, they only apply, or is it the case that they only apply to math and English?
Yes.
Or English language arts. So why is that? Why is it just limited to those
two? It had to do with where to start and funding available and the fact that all our policy since No Child Left Behind has focused on English language arts and mathematics, and that was certainly the area to start. There are a set of standards now in science, which a number of states have adopted, the next generation science standards.
And what are the prospects for kind of expanding it beyond science? I know because other people say, what about history, social science, et cetera?
Well, you know, first we've got to deal with the fact that the English and language arts standards need to be implemented, a huge question. I'm sure we'll spend a great deal of time discussing that. And the fact that there's been some sort of some backtracking. Some of the states who initially adopted the standards have withdrawn. I think 4 states have withdrawn. 9 states have legislation ranging from just one bill introduced to actual bills that are signed to withdraw. And then, you know, the science standards are brand new, and states are just beginning to work on them. So I don't think that many people are thinking about additional subjects at the moment.
You mentioned other states, so that's a good segue to Professor Kirst. How are things going in California? Are we seeing any of the opposition that we're seeing in other states? What are the prospects for implementation of the Common Core in California?
Well, California is proceeding with persistence and patience, and it's going to take a long time. We're not rushing into things. We realize that this is a deep change in education. You're trying to change what's taught every day in the classroom. That takes a while and is some ways bold and many ways risky business, which I'm sure we'll cover a little bit of. But why we're doing so well, in the extent that it's very early to declare victory for sure, but to date, we're not getting the kind of political resistance we're seeing in other states. And I think there's several reasons for that. One, this happened at a great time in California. Our revenue stream has been going up. We have a unified political coalition in Sacramento behind the Common Core, and we like the ideas behind the Common Core, and we're one of the first states to adopt next-generation science standards and aspire to be a national leader in that. So the timing was right. Secondly, the state does not have a lot of the resistance organizations in deep ways that some of the other states do. It's not a big Tea Party state, for example. Third, the California Teachers Association and the AFT have both bought into this because I think in part the way the state has not rushed into this has said we're going to build capacity of the professionals to administer and to implement this in the classrooms. And we're going to hold off on accountability till we're farther down the line. So, you know, we're ratcheting up the capacity of the teachers to do it, and then we'll bring accountability in as appropriate. We had some money. We gave $1.25 billion in state money into it. One hopeful thing that is overlooked in these discussions is higher education. We have worked very hard to bring higher education into this. And we're the only state where all 4 systems, including the private colleges and universities, have endorsed the Common Core. The University of California is revising its A to G approvals to align with Common Core. We have a National Governors Association grant to redo teacher preparation. And I think if people want to understand the Common Core and a driver that will happen here, they should look at the new SAT and PSAT. Those are more Common Core aligned in some ways than some of the state assessments around the country. So we see a confluence of factors coming to help us out, but it'll take time, and we're going to persist.
And could you just clarify, because I'm not exactly clear on this myself, that the state adopted the Common Core standards in 2010, and they are implementing the standards. Are the standards actually implemented now, or where do we stand? Well, or are they being implemented, or how long will it take for them to be fully implemented?
Well, I'm sure Christina can talk about that as well, but it's a mixed situation. Some schools and districts and teachers and classrooms are doing pretty well. Some are just at the beginning stages. We have 6.2 million pupils and 11,200 schools, so I don't know exactly where that is. I don't have my hands on all of that pulse, but we know that we've got momentum, and we're building, and our policies are aligned. They fit together. They're not moving in different directions. We really thought that through as well. So but we will be doing implementation studies. The first assessment will be in the spring of 2015. That'll be a baseline. I think a lot of people will get clearer on what this is when they actually see the assessment.
That's when the first test, the assessment.
Yeah, it'll be called Smarter Balanced Assessment. It'll have each pupil will take an hour to an hour and a half performance exam. This is sort of like driving the car rather than taking the multiple choice test, so they'll have to solve problems, use various sources to do it. And then there's extended response, not just fill in the bubble, and the all our assessments will be computer adaptive. If you're answering hard questions, we give you more hard questions. If you're not doing well, we give you easier questions. So we're going to have 4.2 million people taking this on a computer. So that we're really changing the technology base of California schools. I mean, just to do this is Herculean.
I understand that this is the largest number of people that ever have taken an online test in the history of the United States, or history of since there have been online tests. So before students get to the test, they have to be prepared to take these tests or assessments.
Yes.
Christina Lundy, and we're not asking you to give us the whole class. We'd love to come to your class and get a demonstration. But if I came to your classroom today, would I see you doing things differently as a result of the Common Core?
You would see, if you walked into my classroom, you would walk in and see the students are sitting in groups. And they're sitting, they also have places where they can sit alone. You would also see the classroom with Chromebooks ready to go and with students able to get to them and students able to put them away the way they want to and need to. You would also see a whiteboard full of either presently what they're learning or blank, prepared for what they're going to be doing that day and getting their learning so that we can document it. You would also see with the LCD projector, and you would see either an iPad plugged in or the desktop plugged in so that we could have lessons ready to go or student projects being ready to be shown. Simultaneously, you will see bean bags because the students still love to read in a comfy, cozy spot. You'll see shelves with books, fiction and nonfiction. You're also going to see student toolboxes with their tools that they need to have, still with sticky notes, still with pencils, but yet they all have their Google Drive accounts. And they all have access to their online learning tools that they use. So when you walk into the room, you're also going to see on the schedule ways that students are learning alone, because they still have to be held accountable as a solo person. As I joke with them, when you go to a job interview, you do not get to take your BFF. You've got to be able to stand on your own 2 feet, and you need to be able to express yourself. However, when you're working throughout the day, the students know, oh, this is going to be partner time. This is going to be group time. Oh, I'm back to solo time. So the day is organized in a way so that students are alone, students can count on a learning partner, and students can count on a team. And
Christina, I mean, what you're describing sounds like good teaching. The kinds of things you're doing is what one would expect good teachers to be doing. Is this different, I mean, in terms of what the Common Core is now encouraging you to do?
I would say it is reflective of the Common Core because of the collaboration that is so necessary for the students to access the standards. So many, part of the 21st century piece is the 4 C's. They need to collaborate, they need to communicate, they need to use critical thinking skills, and they need to be creative. And so throughout the day, you need to see those 4 components throughout your lessons, whether it be with your language arts, reading and writing, which for me, even though it's reading and writing and language standards, that's used with my science and my social studies because that's the content that gets the kids all excited, and so those are the skills that they need to learn. That would be a piece that is huge with Common Core. I know they're isolated, but the way to teach them effectively is going to be to use that content in your science and your social studies. Math, they need to talk. They need to talk a lot, and they need to be able to express themselves. So those are pieces that might have been there in years before, but now it's expected, and we need to foster and support our teachers so that there's a comfort to do that. Does that answer your question about that?
It does, but I'm going to now jump to Susan Furman from Teachers College at Columbia University, because I think one of the big issues that's been raised about the Common Core is, are teachers prepared? I'd be interested to know what you are doing at Teachers College to... I know you do a lot of other things in preparing teachers, but what are you doing in that sphere, and What is your thoughts on how prepared teachers are at this stage? Because obviously, if teachers aren't prepared, this is not going
to
work.
Well, let me start with your reference to "Isn't this just good teaching?" Mm-hmm. Because there are many things about the Common Core that are much more rigorous, sophisticated, and challenging than teaching that we've seen. The standards are built on our current understanding of learning progressions, which is cognitive science studies of how children acquire understanding, the steps they go through to understand concepts like fractions or flotation, and how they build knowledge. So in math, there is a lot of emphasis on understanding why things are so, understanding what you're actually doing when you're subtracting and adding, and how multiplication is just a lot of adding, and figuring that out instead of focusing on the, quick tools and techniques that one might learn and will still learn, but the deeper understanding needs to be there. Now, I can say that we have always focused on that deeper understanding at Teachers College, and as the new research comes out, of course, we adapt to it. But this is a big change for many teachers throughout America, and the latest survey I read, which I actually read about today, said that only about a third of districts report that they feel that the standards will be in place this year. There's a great deal of work to be done in making teachers feel comfortable, in developing the curriculum that they can teach that reflects the standards, in making sure that they have the best materials to reflect the standards, and in getting a chance to practice, perhaps with a mentor. All this kind of work needs to occur.
Yeah. And so have you had to sort of rethink about what you do with teachers in teacher preparation? I mean, has that required a sea change on your part?
Well,
or is it a different emphasis?
It's a slight different emphasis. We have, our subject area people have been in the forefront of this kind of thinking that underlies the standards and in trying to take a developmental approach to building knowledge. So our very famous cognitive psychologist is the one who teaches our elementary teachers about teaching math, because his emphasis is on what are the children thinking when they're doing math problems, and that's exactly what the standards imply. But in reading, where we have an exceedingly famous and renowned and well-lauded program, the Teachers College Reading and Writing Project, which may be familiar to you in California as well, that, because of the standards, has had to incorporate more nonfiction in the approaches that teachers are using. I think there are a lot of myths about these standards. One of them is that there's no more fiction reading and it's going to be all nonfiction, but as Christina so well pointed out, much of the nonfiction reading that is appropriately called for by the standards, because much of our life is reading newspapers and analytical articles and the like, much of that reading can be done in science and social studies and in those contexts and not displace the fiction, poetry, drama, and other things that an English curriculum comprises.
Let me just go to my course from the State Board of Education on this topic, because I do think it's a central one. I read an interview you did in Education Week, and you were asked, what keeps you up at night? And you said, implementation and having how do we get 280,000 teachers in California on board on this? So let me ask you, how do we get 280,000 teachers on board?
Right, and business people ask me, what's my human resource plan for 280,000 teachers and 40,000 administrators? And so it's an awfully big state. And so I think that you have to realize this will take time. We're building more infrastructure for teachers to have professional development, to learn together. We're using MOOCs now, MOOCs are a massive online teaching strategies that use online techniques. I don't think we can do this by bringing people to the hotel and feeding them lunch and having some lectures. We're forming networks across the state of schools and districts that can help each other. But we're looking at how deep really we're getting. We have instruments to measure implementation. We're going to look at those. That's one of our major areas of analysis. So, as I say, we want to scale it up, and but I think we're not there yet. We don't have the infrastructure quite yet. The $1.25 billion really didn't do it in depth for everybody. And so this is a job that we're going to have to be very careful and take our time and realize where we are.
And it's also the case that we have a school system in the United States that's decentralized. Mm-hmm. And our current governor, Governor Brown, has made the centerpiece of his education reform driving things to a local level. So it's really probably up to local school districts to take the lead on that. So let me ask you, Christina Lundy, who's teachers in Nevada, middle school?
Fourth grade.
What kind of training did you get, to take this on? And what is your district doing, or what has it done?
So one of the ways that our district is taking care of this is that we've taken the money, and we're well aware that this money is there for our Common Core development. And so it's been set up so that we have technology pieces, because there's a whole technology component with Common Core that for some of us, and yes, I'm one of the old ones, I still think of writing, and I don't do things first with my fingers. And so there's a whole nother level of technology. So part of our money goes towards that. We have another part of our money that goes towards our development. And so we've been able to go to trainings. We've been able to have our own teachers be able to teach teachers, which has been fabulous, because those are teachers that are in our district that have strengths that we have seen in action that we trust. And so we're learning from other teachers. So those teacher leaders are rising up with this opportunity. And then we also professional development, technology, and curriculum. What do we use to teach these standards to? And so being able to have that opportunity to work with our own grade levels, to talk with other teachers, to make our plans, to know what am I supposed to teach in fourth grade and what materials do I need to do that well? I would say that's one of the ways that our district has supported teachers to be able to do this. Our county office providing tons of trainings that we're able to attend that are all driven by how can teachers be best prepared for the Common Core. There's things that are after school, so teachers don't have to miss school. They can go after school, hear speakers that can inspire them. But a lot of it, you also have to have some drive to read it. You've got to sit down and read those standards yourselves. So there's that personal drive of, I'm accountable for this. I need to teach this. I need to read it. And it's not fun reading, but it's definitely, you feel that much more empowered when you take that time. So looking at a little piece at a time.
And do you feel you have gotten the preparation you need to do this?
Or I feel I am getting it.
I've gotten some.
I'm actively in it. I feel excited one day and overwhelmed another. And I'm sure if any of you are educators out there, there's this level of overwhelmness to be prepared. But I think if we all can go, hey, we're all feeling like this, then we're going to be able to figure out how to work through it. So, yes, I feel overwhelmed too. But, hey, it's all right because we're going to dive in and the kids still show up every day. Whether I'm ready.
They're still showing up. But you raised a good point. Reading the standards. The standards are... Anybody can read the standard.
They're accessible.
Where can people find these standards if you actually want to?
Well, they're on the California Department of Education website.
It's on the website.
Common Core Standards, California Department of Education.
There's an app.
Not light reading, but probably would be good for people.
Can I just say a word about the commonness in the Common Core?
Okay.
I think that's
a good idea.
Where did that come from? Governors and state education leaders getting together and deciding that algebra was algebra, in Maine or California, and that it was time to do what other countries did and had to have some national level guidance, especially in this so decentralized system, as you pointed out. But they were not federal, they were national. They came from the group of states coming together. Unfortunately, a lot of the backlash has been because of federal intrusion in education, and the standards did become a bit federalized when they became tied to Race to the Top and to waivers that the Department of Education was giving for states that wanted to vary their No Child Left Behind implementation. The conditions were that you had to adopt the standards. So I hope that we keep in mind over time, because this is going to be a long, difficult process, that the commonness is something that I think we're going to come to value, and that it's not this big top-down plot. It's an idea that we live in one country where we might share expectations for education, not for everything, but for a certain set of core things.
Let me ask you, Mike Kirst, about you were a strong proponent of the Common Core. Why do you think this particular reform is going to be more successful than some of the others? Just said, say, No Child Left Behind, which also had great goals, and every kid was going to be proficient by, I think, last spring. Well,
that's a pretty ambitious goal. Well, I think if you look at the California situation, you know, we're below the national average on almost all rankings of academics. And sometimes with some groups, we're considerably below. And so you could sit tight and say, we're going to keep going with whatever we've been doing and incrementally try and work on that. Or you can say, here's an idea that might just blast us loose. And it's bold and it's a gamble, but sitting there and saying, you know, we're going to do 2% more than we did last year, when an opportunity like this comes along where somebody has really reconceptualized in modern terms, this goes back, of course, to progressive education and its roots, what we can do. So I think that's the basic one of the basic reasons we're in it. Now, why it can be more successful, hopefully we've learned from history. I mean, Jerry Brown's 76, I'm 75. One thing, every year we advance with more humility. We were once in office at 35, and I had tons more answers than I have now, and so does he. He banged away at trying to improve a charter school in Oakland and, you know, didn't get as far as he'd hoped, and, you know, he doesn't think that you can turn around schools with some quickie thing. So we are trying to learn from the lessons of the history of reforms. The reforms at work have largely been additions. We add special ed, we add kindergarten, we add health education. We know how to reform by addition. This is, as Christina has outlined, much more fundamental change in the classroom. That requires a much more sophisticated implementation grasp. So, you know, we're trying not to repeat the lessons of bad history, and we've read the lessons of history.
And I just wanted to direct a question from the floor to Christina Lundy. Says, I'm a parent and wondering what I tell my son who used to be really good, quote unquote, in math, but who is now struggling with the new math curriculum.
Oh, yes. Well, first, you want to make sure he knows that he's still good in math.
And just what is there? Yes. Is there a new math curriculum?
So I would say with the math that we are looking at students using a multiple of ways to solve problems. And so when it used to be algorithm, memorize it, do it, now it's, well, how about this way? Oh, let's go over here and look at this way. Tell me why. When you are subtracting, as some of us would have called borrowing, it's regrouping or now ungrouping, and there's a purpose for it. And the purpose is that we want the kids to understand the place value. So use humor and use your online resources. I myself had to refer to them when my own son was going into some math that I hadn't gotten to yet. He was ahead of me. And so we together discovered LearnZillion. We discovered going on to Khan Academy to find out, and we used our publisher website. How do we teach this? How is it being said? But instead it was, let's use our resources. Let's look together and work with them. I have found it's really great to see the kids learn perseverance and stamina, which is part of the Common Core mathematical practices, that they're able to persevere and keep working on it and continue that stamina. Fluency hasn't gone away. They still need to have that accuracy, but they need to be able to problem solve it, show it with multiple models. That's the biggie. It's about having multiple models and showing it and then expressing it. That's a lot, but they can do it. And we just have to understand we may not know all the answers when we're working with our child. And so use your resources, breathe through it. So,
in case you've just tuned into this program on the radio, this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and we are tonight hosting an education summit about the national rollout of the Common Core K-12 state standards. Our guests are Dr. Susan Furman, president of Columbia University's Teachers College in New York, Michael Kirst is president of the State Board of Education, and a Stanford University professor emeritus of education, and Christina Lundy is the literacy coordinator and a teacher in Novato at the Olive Elementary School, and I'm Lewis Friedberg, executive director of EdSource and your moderator. And you can catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter and hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and on our YouTube channel. Let me just go to some more questions from the floor because they also address some of the concerns that people have had. So I have this question. Our district has imposed on us a canned curriculum that is of limited value, simply calling it Common Core. Help. isn't that one of the concerns that you get all this curriculum material and it says Common Core aligned? How do we know that these curriculum materials are actually doing the job or going to do the job they're supposed to? Dr. Furman?
Well, I'm actually looking at Mike because California has had a tradition of adopting textbooks. Now you're going to be endorsing textbooks. So certainly the state is examining which curricula out there, which publisher series are actually aligned to the Common Core. Is that the case?
Yeah, we do. The state does curricular frameworks, which guide teachers on how to actually teach the Common Core. And then we do endorse instructional materials. And we believe the things that we have endorsed are quite good, but there's lots of materials out there. And we really want local districts to explore and look around. I would think the canned curriculum won't work, and hopefully they'll drop it at some point. But there is a lot of guidance from the state on materials, and I think the first generation of materials, they basically changed a few things and stamped Common Core on it. And so I think the next generation of it that we've already seen is getting better. And so they need to move on to 2.0.
And could you just clarify what Susan Furman just referred to, that the state endorsed as opposed to adopted textbook? Yeah. What's the distinction there?
Well, the distinction is we used to have a categorical earmarked amount of money. It was for instructional materials. We sent it out to each district from Sacramento, but they could only buy books and supplementary materials that were on the state adopted list. And so the bill was passed to free this system up. The thinking was, if it's common and it's Common Core, why don't they take materials from New York or North Dakota or something? So, and there's a lot out there on the web, and some of the teachers have really found good stuff on their own, better than some of the early stuff. So that's really what we have done. And it goes back to my humility theme. You know, at this point, we've come to the view we're just not smart enough in Sacramento to figure it all out for 1,000 districts, 1,200 charter schools, and 11,200 schools. And, you know, we run from Maine to South Carolina and California, if you'd put us on the East Coast. And it's just too big. We couldn't do it.
And that's why it's great to have a teacher on the panel. But also we should be, you know, aware that your district is not necessarily at all representative of anybody or any district except your own. But Christina Lundy, do you have the materials you need? Do you feel, is that another issue that's been raised, whether the materials are there to implement?
So I'm going to address the whole thing with the curriculum and teacher's manuals. Teacher's manuals are going to provide us with resources. And I've been fortunate in my 18 years of teaching that I've had administrators that have reminded me, that's a resource. What do you need to teach your kids? What do your kids need to be taught? What are the standards that need to be addressed? So, using a curriculum, for me, has always been, I go to it. I need to work this problem. I need to get the vocabulary. How does my resource suggest? Ooh, I like that, but I'm also going to refer to the training that I got with a trainer that from another area. So the curriculum piece, and as teachers, we're still the crafter in our classrooms. And we need to use those standards, and we need to use the curriculum that our taxpayers pay for, and we need to weave them so that they meet the standards for our students. So curriculum is wonderful to have. Do I have everything I need right now? No. But am I working towards it? Yes. But it's only because we're figuring out what are the standards that we need to address in our classroom, so what resources are going to be best before we just go spend the money. So,
another question which relates to that, I'd like to address it to both Susan Firm and Mike Kirst. This is a question from the audience. What measures are being put into place to address the economic differences between school districts? And it says that, namely, Nevada, which is in Marin County, versus Oakland or Richmond. And mm-hmm. the same question could be posed in any school, any state across the country.
I'll address it sort of nationally, and then this is a California-specific question, but the Common Core is not the solution to all our problems in this country, and no one should think it is. You know, in education, we're dealing with increasing socioeconomic inequality, and the schools are being asked to help ameliorate that when it's a problem that society should be addressing in a much more holistic fashion. So the fact that education spending is still often dependent in most states on the wealth of the local school district is a problem in itself because of what the schools can afford, and it's compounded because children in poverty can't get the extra help and services they need when the school districts are underspending. So,
Mike Kirst?
Yeah, well, California, and I didn't know that I'd live to see it, passed the first big school finance reform since Proposition 13 reformed it in 1978. So we had a historical accretion of very detailed state programs that told districts how to spend it in these narrow categories. And we loosened the system up, but in answer to the question directly, the old system was not adapted to pupil needs. The new system gives more money, called supplemental grants, also called pupil weights. You weight pupils that are more needy than others. So they get 25% more and for if they have a low concentration. Moreover, we have a theory of high concentration, that there are areas of poverty and extreme disorganization, and they need even more money. So we have 25% for each child, and if they're concentrated at more than 55% in the school district, we give 40% more. So districts like Alum Rock and all low-income Hispanic in East San Jose, they'll go up 50% per pupil in the next 5-6 years. So we have adjusted the formula for the needs of the pupils. And it's really a conceptual breakthrough. There's not enough money in the system, so this is more of an equity move than it is an adequacy move of raising the base to, say, even the national average. But at least we are proceeding with a very different kind of allocation system.
I should mention, I mean, this is a major reform in California, and Professor Kirst was one of the architects of that plan. There was a seminal paper that was written with Alan Burson and Goodwin Liu several years ago called Weighted Student Formula.
Right. Low-income English learners who are not low-income and foster children. So if you have those kinds of children, they have a bigger
And somehow
allocation.
Was able to convince the governor to actually go with this plan. So let me just follow up on that. Another question is, how do students with special needs and those who have individual education plans fit into the Common Core? I know special ed is a major concern in California, probably nationally. But let me just ask you, Christina, do you have special ed kids?
I have students in my class who have IEPs. I have students in my class with unidentified IEPs.
Individual education plans.
So students who have different needs or more specific needs. One of the comments I've heard from one of our resource teachers, a pro, is how the standards are written, you can see across the grade levels. So when they are making goals, one of the things when they're making their individual IEP goals, they can look at that same strand and go, okay, well, even though this child's a fourth grader, we can look at 4.1 in reading, and we can go down to second grade or first grade if that's where the child is at that level. It is also something we're working on. How do you support a child to express themselves when that's not their area of strength or that's the area that is really deficit for them? So do we have those answers? No. It requires a lot of collaboration with your team and talking with your special ed teachers and talking with your regular ed teachers. Scaffolding needs to be there for them. It needs to be there to support them. That's how we've addressed it.
And Mike Kirst, I know you have been very focused
on
special ed.
Yeah, we have a statewide.
Is the Common Core going to work for special ed kids, or how is that going to work?
Right. We have a statewide task force coming out with a report in December, maybe January, on how to do this. It's an area that we knew we had to work harder on. And so this area of special education needs a really major overhaul. And so we're going to be rolling these ideas out in the new year, and I think for the next 4 years will be a major focus. Yes, they can work with a Common Core, and the parents and the other groups are really want Common Core for their kids. They don't want to be sitting there with some old, you know, traditional curriculum that is not appropriate to their needs and their abilities. So this is a real new area of development that'll be a four-year project coming up.
So everything you talk about, it sounds all reasonable. It sounds things are rolling along. But there has been a lot of opposition, and not only from the right, and of course it's not only a left-right thing because there's people on the right who support it, but Susan Furman, in New York, there's been a lot of opposition. Could you just inform us Californians what's happening there in New York?
Well, New York is certainly not a Tea Party state either, so the opposition was not from the right there, although the states that have dropped out, I should make clear, was mostly around politics, the gubernatorial elections coming up, and opposition to federal intrusion. But the opposition that's coming from the left, from teachers and parents, that we've seen in New York has to do with the rush to implementation there. Unlike the patience and persistence mantra, which I wish we had heard in New York, there were tests that counted, put into place right away, and they had
counted
to...
Counted for teachers' evaluation?
And for students. And they had to backtrack, and then they put a moratorium in place, but only after very vociferous objection. So people were teaching and being held accountable to the standards before they really learned how to do that. And, of course, there was opposition. I believe that this rush is in part due to Race to the Top, because that was funded with stimulus money, you'll remember, and it had to be spent in short period.
That was the Obama administration's $4.3 billion program that states had to compete for.
That's right, and New York was a race for the top state, and the standards had to be in place. Teacher evaluation based on student test scores had to be in place, and several other things as part of the Race to the Top program, and the money had to be spent by 2013. And the Common Core is a huge developmental agenda. We have to develop the curriculum. We have to develop teachers. We have to develop new assessments that are worthy of more sophisticated understanding and, you know, really reflect that. And yet, this was all rushed into place. So New York has had a fair amount of noise and backlash, and there's been some backtracking. We're now... there's been a moratorium on counting the tests for both students and teachers.
Is the union in New York still opposed to the Common Core? Where do things stand right now?
Well, I don't know that there's been any official change in position, but I know that anecdotally I hear that as teachers begin to use the new materials and the new curriculum, and New York has put on its website a lot of related curriculum, that they're coming to appreciate some of the value. And we'll see if that appreciation overcomes the still resentment for being put in a position where they were told they had to, that everything rested on their ability to teach these things that in some cases they had never heard of. And students, we, you know, stories of students being sick on testing day, literally sick, not because they were kept out of testing so the average scores would increase, that happened too, but kids who were literally sick because of the pressure, knowing how much this test was going to count for their teachers, and yet the Common Core was by no means in place.
So. Let me deepen this a little bit, because California's had a lot of disputes with the federal government. I received a letter because the State Board of Education is the federal recipient of funds from Arnie Duncan, threatening to cut $3.5 billion worth of federal aid from our system. And so, you know, even though Obama carried this state by 22%, we've had incredible tension. And I think if you got one thing from this discussion tonight, maybe it's how hard and how thoughtful you have to be in implementing this. So Arne Duncan and Obama, they have their agenda. And then we had our agenda. And everything I've learned said, I can't implement both of these. We're already risking policy overload on the local school districts. I got to choose one or the other. So the choice was, with the governor's full backing and the state superintendent, was we're going to stick with our agenda and take whatever consequences they have. You know, we never thought he could cut $3.5 billion, but, you know, and we also thought we could string him out in court till he was out of office. But that, so anyway, that's why we have really, I just don't think you can do that much. And so we deliberately passed on some of these things because, one, we thought it was rushing. He told me I had to have a teacher evaluation using assessments for large part of the evaluation in 11,000 schools by 2015. And I said, I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking, I'm phasing in an entirely new curriculum, an entirely new assessment. What, 2015? That's the first time we're ever going to give it. I've never even seen it. We cut testing by 51% since 2011 totally. He wanted more back. So, you know, we have a lot of tension. The governor went to see him twice, sat in his office, tried to reason with him, and we didn't get anywhere. So we're going our own way, and so far we haven't paid much consequences, but we'll see.
Can I just don't want to get too far afield here, but this is a bit of a conundrum that you have a president who one wouldn't have expected necessarily to have continued some of the policies that were in place before that haven't been terribly successful. Any of you wish to comment on that?
No, I've said what I've said. I'm president.
Well, let me ask you, Susan Furman, is there any indication that the administration is rethinking where some of the policies that were in place?
No. There's 2 years left, and I think they're focusing on other things, you know, measuring college outcomes, for example. But I hope there's some talk about finally reauthorizing No Child Left Behind. I imagine 2017 would be the soonest it would occur, and getting away from some of the destructive elements of it, which have brought us to where we are with testing in this country. I've been pushing the notion of sampling both students and questions so that we can get much more authentic assessments, cover the whole curriculum, not test everybody every year. There's been lately a flurry of statements coming out, including some that are defending yearly testing as essential. And one very important thing that No Child Left Behind did, and I think we all appreciate, is that we've been able to track subgroups in school populations, kids who are often neglected when you just looked at the average school score and you weren't seeing that the African-American kids were not getting access to the same challenging curriculum as other students. That was very valuable. And I think that, I hope that the research community can shed some light on how you can do that, show subgroup performance without all the suppressive testing. You can use some sort of sampling. We have all sorts of ways of tracking student progress now with various learning platforms that schools have where every grade is recorded. Surely we have enough data on students so we can track these things without the suppressive testing.
And can I ask you a quick question on this? Although I know this could really get us into some deep academic jargon or education jargon, but part of the Common Core is supposed to be what they call formative assessments that are not the formal tests that kids will get it next spring, but actually help teachers and students improve or find out where their skills or where their deficits are. Can you talk
should be an assessment that's for learning purposes, for the teachers to learn where the students are, for the students to see their own progress and to be able to monitor them. That understanding is not always what we see. Some things that are really just interim assessments, which are more frequent regular tests, are called formative assessments, and no one really does the learning from them. I believe that the Smarter Balanced assessment includes formative assessments.
Yes.
So maybe
the Smarter Balanced is the consortium that put together the
California
big
belongs to.
Yeah, there's about 15 states in Smarter Balanced. Yeah, we see that an assessment can be part of an instructional system. So there's all this, testing. But the Smarter Balanced system is set up that if students aren't learning or are learning, they can look at where they are in the interim before a final summative test. But moreover, the system offers them help on how to reteach and how to think of new strategies. So it has a digital library. So it's not just here's the end of course test. It's an integrated instructional system. And so that's one of the reasons that we have persisted with it. And that's still being developed, the whole instructional system side, but that'll roll out in January.
At the point that the formative assessments are supposed to be given
during the school year
as part of
are they learning fractions and what part aren't they learning? And then you can also get help on, well, how could I think of another strategy to teach them practice?
I see Christina Lundy nodding ahead. Are you doing formative assessments? What is that?
Assessments for a teacher is then, instead of being like, oh, they just don't know it, we're done, is, okay, this person doesn't get this aspect of it, so let's continue to work with them. And so instead of a child feeling like, that was it, and I don't get it, this is a way to find out, do I need to do more models with them? Do they need a small group instruction? Do they need to attend a morning intervention class? Do they need just a peer buddy to reinforce it with them? But the opportunity is that it's not done and that they're able to keep learning. And that's that formative piece is huge, because that can empower students for learning, but it really can empower the teacher to be able to do what she or he needs to do to target that instruction. Powerful.
We are going to try to get in a few questions directly from you guys, so rather than going through me. So I'm going to ask another question, and then we'll just get a few questions from the floor. But here's another question which I think is also a key one, is with the increase of technology's place in the schools, how do you see tech playing a role in both teaching and reaching the Common Core standards? I'll just start. Are you doing anything with technology in your classroom, Christina Lundy? Yeah.
Yes, I'm definitely dabbling with it in there. It is not the end all. So it's not going to be great, put them in front of a screen, they're going to get it, put them on a program. That's not the technology. Our kids need to know how to use technology. Their world is going to be using it in a regular way, thinking up how do you build tools that are technology focused. So yes, there's technology simple as presentations on Google Presentation or PowerPoint, but also knowing how to research accurately and effectively, not just picking up that Wikipedia has everything end all and it's factual. So they have to learn how to be critical thinkers when they're looking up the internet. For example, in my class, if I ask them, where did you find that? On the internet? What do you mean you found it on the internet? What resource did you use? What website? What was the domain name? So just learning, that's internet kind of technology, but there's also the how do you reach kids? How do you communicate? So technology for our students is a regular use of communication. So how are we using that as teachers to communicate with our parents and our kids? So yes, technology is used. Word processing, teaching students how to just simply do alignment right, alignment center. Those are basic important skills that they need to know how to do.
Any one of you want to comment on that? Because
I think there will be an increasing number of games and simulations and various tools that will hopefully engage as well as assess and teach. And with a really good tool, the students' learning is assessed as they go along, and then, as Mike said, adaptive. The content is adjusted, so the approach to teaching the child what he or she needs or the concepts he or she may have missed will vary depending on how the child is doing, and those kinds of tools can really help support teachers' efforts and when used well.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, technology, I mean, students are going to be taking these tests online. And one of the things we're looking at EdSource is that elementary school kids have to take this online, and they're not really good at the keyboards. I mean, if you've got to type typing.
Typing.
We're actually looking at our school
districts. We absolutely have to go back to teaching typing. There's no question.
So, let me go to the floor and ask. And I know we're not going to get everybody's questions in, but let me go to you. And if you can identify yourself and ask a question.
You've got to come to a mic.
Oh, Mike. You've got to go to the mic. I'm sorry. So... let's go to the, we'll get to you next, yeah.
Hi, so before Common Core began, I know the huge complaint was that there were so many standards that students and teachers were just drowning and they were sprinting through all this breadth over depth and not getting real meaning and understanding. And Common Core, the idea was that it was going to make the standards fewer and simpler so that you really could get to that depth and understanding. But then there were so many voices in the process that the complaint arose that the standards had just become inflated and they really hadn't succeeded at simplifying and reducing the number. Did they succeed or not? Where do we stand on that?
And could you identify yourself?
I'm Grace Rubenstein. I'm a reporter.
Reporter, okay.
I think there's definitely fewer. What do you think?
There are fewer, there are still more than what that same thing was heard. But there are fewer, and that's why that effective piece of how you use it with your content, that's how you can reach them effectively. If you're going to teach them in isolation, it's going to be too much. But if you put them in effective places with your content, then you're going to be able to reach them.
Can I just comment on that? I studied, Mike and I actually studied together, the earlier iteration of the standards movement in the 90s when states were each developing their own sets of standards. And one story I loved is that New Jersey, I think it was, had a round of comment where you could only delete. Because the natural tendency was for everyone to just add more standards.
Next question from the floor.
Hi, my name is Carlo, and thanks for coming tonight. I'm helping a lot of college access groups in nationwide, get college more affordable for kids. And my question is, you know, what happens to the people who are, or the students who are currently in the system right now? How are they going to be affected by this? I mean, namely, sophomores, seniors, and juniors. Is it going to be a bait and switch? How are they going to do with the test scores and
how is this going to affect their college applications?
Right.
We're cognizant of them. I mean, of this. I mean, it's like sort of having somebody. They didn't have any of the medical treatment yet. You're expecting some effect. I mean, they've had 9 years of another education, presumably, and it'll take a while to the 10th and 11th grades fully implement this. So I think there'll be a transition period, but the. The most intriguing thing with that is that the college assessments, SAT and ACT, are switching over, particularly SAT. So I'm curious about that. That's just a huge shift. I mean, I It's nothing like any SAT that anybody in this room took. And so I don't know where we're going to go with that one, frankly. That's up to the colleges.
Next question from the floor.
My name is Allison Collins, and I'm an educator working at San Francisco Unified School District in the assessment office. So we work on supporting formative assessment in the schools. And I'm also a parent, and I'm a blogger. San Francisco Public School Mom is my blog. And what I find is in conversations with parents and also in following this implementation of the Common Core through the media is there's a lot of confusion, especially from parents. They're actually really confused about just the differences between what is the Common Core versus what is instruction versus what are assessments. And when you see people even complaining about Common Core, sometimes what they're really complaining about is bad assessments or bad curriculum. And I'm seeing teachers are really overloaded in trying to communicate all this. And they're telling me we need resources. And what I'm interested in at the district level and also at the state level is what is the role of districts and states in helping teachers in communicating kind of how they're connected and also how they're different things.
The state has been slow on this, I think, and we're just ramped up some things that are significant in the last 3 or 4 months. And we're integrated fully with PTA. So the PTA has, we have an entire communications toolkit which works through, not to the general public, that's really a breach, but works through exactly what the question was about. How do we work from good materials that describe this and communication techniques that go to schools, to teachers, to parents, that route. So that's exactly the route we're pursuing. And it's just, I hope you'll see more of this, I'm sure you will, in the next few months. But I'm hoping PTA, which is active in San Francisco, they really have these materials. And we need others to step up to the plate. We can't do this with government. So we're handing this out to other voluntary organizations and all of that. But you haven't seen it because it's just beginning.
And 1 minute, because we're actually coming, we have just a few minutes left. But
and this is a great place for your admin team to be there because providing, I know our district office will have parent meetings to have parents there. I know that our county office will provide parent meetings. I know that my site administrator will do coffee chats to have parents just to come in and talk about those kinds of things. So I know for our back to school nights, we use the PTA form to give to parents because it is written for parents through the PTA. So just continuing to do that, the website, I know not everybody goes on the websites, but at least if there's a link there, that gets people there. So just keep going.
Yeah. I see we have many more questions. We unfortunately can't get to those questions, but hopefully we can continue the discussion after the session. But we reached the point in our program where we'd like to just hear some quick final thoughts from our panelists. Christina Lundy, who's actually in the classroom every day. How are you feeling right now about Common Core? Are you
I'm excited. I'm excited. I think I'm excited and overwhelmed. And I think if there was one thing to share for other educators, see this as a license for your creativity to come through, even when you're overwhelmed and tired and exhausted and not ready for it. I'm there with you. But see this as a license to be able to teach the way your kids need to be taught. And so use your resources. We have so many accessible to us. Fine-tune your vision sometimes. Close off, say I'm only going to internet search for 10 minutes, and then be done. And find that way. Collaborate with each other. And just breathe. But find your license for creativity.
Mike Kirst is lying awake at night thinking about 280,000
teachers. Yeah, right. So I would say that from what I've learned, I would look between 218 and 220 to see how we're doing. You know, we're off to a good start, but there's a long road, that's what we're thinking is we'll wait. Then I'm sure there'll be some mistakes along the road. And the biggest fear is it will botch the implementation, and that'll undercut the support we have in California. I don't think we're going to be defeated from political and ideological movements. We can only, I think, probably be defeated from poor implementation that then spreads negativity and just says, the hell with it.
And Susan Furman, you've got the whole country to worry about.
Yes. Well, with, like Mike, I like to take the long view, and, but that's always a challenge because we are worried about the kids who are in school right now. And, you know, so it's always a tension. But I can remember in the 90s when President Clinton proposed a national set of standards and a national test that lasted for about a minute. There was, you know, huge uproar. And the idea that states would come together and develop standards is, you know, a big sea change since then. So if we take the long view, I think there's reason to be optimistic.
Well, the Common Club is delighted to have hosted this special Common Core Education Summit. We want to thank the many educators in the audience and to especially thank our panelists for sharing their talent and passion for educating the children of the 21st century. We are really grateful for your time and your ideas. Susan Furman, President of Teachers College at Columbia University. Michael Kurz, President of the State California State Board of Education. Christina Lundy, who teaches elementary school, fourth grade in Nevada. I'm Louis Friedberg. And now this concludes our meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. The meeting is adjourned.